It's a great pleasure to welcome Danuta Hubner back to the LSE. She was remarking that she remembers sitting and listening to President Kwasniewski speaking in this room some while ago. It's a particular pleasure for me because this is someone I have known and liked for many years and who has had a career which has overlapped between the academic and the policy world. She's worked as an academic and on a number of occasions in the Polish government and also in the UN Economic Commission for Europe, where, as I recall, she was very much concerned with the problems of the Western Balkans, the Stability Pact, and other such related issues. She is now the European Commissioner for Regional Policy in an EU of 25. I'm struck by how often the debate in Western Europe forgets that we are now an EU of 25 and assumes that we are still an EU of 15 plus 10 new members who we haven't quite absorbed, and we therefore look forward particularly to hearing what you want to say about regional policy in an EU of 25 that may even be an EU of 27 or 28 by the time the term of this commission has been completed. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming at this late hour of the day to share your time with me. I thank you very much for this, and it's an enormous pleasure for me to be here. And I remember it was in 98, I was just somewhere there in the first row sitting and listening to what the President of Poland was saying in LSE, and that's my second time, but for the first time I'm here, really. It was a chance to talk to you, and I'm certainly very grateful to Lord Wallace and also to the LSE Students' Union, Polish Society, for this opportunity to address you today. Well, it is, as you know, probably, because you are somehow related, probably in a different ways to LSE, that it is a real privilege, though rather daunting, I would say, to be invited to an institution with such a superb academic reputation as your school. And I am here with you, talking to you at the beginning of 2005, which I think is already an important year for all of us in the enlarged European Union. There are many decisions, many difficult moments ahead of us this year. There is certainly the whole process of ratifying the new constitution, which we have embarked in Europe. There is also the extremely painful process of negotiating the new financial perspective for the Union for the period 2007-2013. And this is also important for me because part of this painful negotiations is also the negotiations on the new generation of the cohesion policy. This year is also important because most likely it will be marked by new decisions on the Stability and Growth Pact, which some of us might like, some not, but those decisions will most likely be taken. And this is also the year where we are making our second approach to the so-called Lisbon strategy. So this year, and there will be many, many other, probably also the beginning of negotiations with new potential member states, so it's going to be a year sort of full of important decisions. And as Britain also gears up for the referendum on the EU constitutional treaty, today's topic, the European policy, regional policy and the Lisbon agenda is probably completely unlikely to successfully compete with the shape of bananas or the fate of British sausage for the headlines in the tabloids. Nevertheless, I will try, as it is, I think, indeed quite high on the agenda of the Union at this moment and appears in two linked but separate debates. First, the current seven-year, as you know, regional development programs financially supported from the budget, the current budget, which expires in 2006, the program will also come to the end in December 2006. And we have, therefore, the Commission myself, we have proposed a new set of proposals for the reform of the cohesion policy to the Council and to the Parliament, and these proposals are currently negotiated in this broader context that I mentioned of financial perspective. And let me say that in my view the need to have a new approach to the cohesion policy, the need for reform of the cohesion policy should be, I think, seen obvious to us for various reasons. And the first one is of course linked to the fact that the Union has recently enlarged to incorporate 10 new member states, and Bulgaria and Romania will join in January 2007. And all of these new member states, but Malta and Cyprus, have developed as transition economies over the last 15 years, and though growing, as you know, very fast, they are still relatively poor and short of capital, so they have joined Union as relatively less prosperous countries. So Union investment in these countries through the structural funds, if used properly, is bound to give, in my view, a high return. And so in helping these countries to grow more quickly, the cohesion policy will be, in my view, generating more rapid rate of economic growth in the Union as a whole, more rapid than would otherwise be possible. And then on the second issue, the Lisbon agenda, the program, unprecedented in my view, program for structural reform agreed by member states back in March 2000 is currently being adjusted, and the Commission presented its proposal for the midterm review yesterday in the Parliament. And the main point, as you probably some of you might know, is a sharper focus on jobs and growth. And it is exactly these two issues, the new approach to cohesion policy seen in the context of financial perspective negotiations and the revitalization of the Lisbon agenda. Around these two parallel strands, I would like to address my remarks on the cohesion policy. Though I can imagine, I know it also, that in some people's eyes, the EU regional policy on the one hand and the Lisbon agenda on the other hand might seem strange bedfellows, but both are built around the same three pillars, which is the economic, social and environmental sustainability. And also both are working for a growth and employment and competitiveness agenda. So my conviction, which is widely shared at the level of the regions, is that we must even reinforce this link between the two, between the regional policy and the Lisbon, in the interest of the prosperity of the entire continent. So that link, in my view, is already clear, and this is also possible due to the fact that cohesion policy is not merely about the redistribution of the funds, and surprisingly many people look at it, and it's not the redistribution between the rich and the poor. It's not nothing to do with Robin Hood, and it's not also about handouts, and it's not about permanent subsidies. I think we should try to kill this stereotype, and we should try to understand, to make European citizens, those who are not involved directly, also understand that it is all to do with investment, it is all to do with modernizing the European economy, with promoting growth and sustainability, and producing also all sorts of beneficial spillover effects. It is about investing in human capital, in physical capital, in innovation. The oldest of you might remember that when the decisions was made on Lisbon 5 years ago, the overall aim of the Lisbon was something we some of us, I must say, even at that time already saw it as a little bit naive. Mission of the Lisbon agenda, which was to make the EU the most competitive and dynamic knowledge-based economy in the world by 2010. And there were also very specific targets with regards to the research and development, with regards to the labor market, like, for example, moving the employment rate on average in Europe being at the level of 63% to 70% in this period. We also established at that time the special sort of instruments to implement the agenda, the economic reforms, investment, growth enhancing investment on the one hand, which was in the responsibility of the individual member states, and on the other hand, all those activities which were more in line with what the Commission is traditionally responsible for, which is the legal framework, particularly the completion of the internal market, but also the Lisbon envisaged that it will be the Commission who would be charged with the process of peer review of monitoring, but without, however, this famous shaming and blaming the member states of the member states in a too visible way. So no wonder that progress with the Lisbon agenda has been largely very disappointing, and we know this from the recent Wim Cox report on the first 5 years of Lisbon. I wouldn't like to enter into any detailed presentation or diagnosis of this, but let me just recall four or five main points where we failed indeed on Lisbon strategy. I think the first, if I could mention the labor market, I think despite the relatively good labor market performance in the next years, of course I say relatively, because we still have the unemployment rate at the level of 8-9% in Europe, and we have it close to 20% in some of the new member states. So we still, in spite of some improvement, we are still very far in terms of reaching what might be called full employment. So, and we shall certainly not be there in 2010. Then on productivity growth, I think we continue to be on the long-term downward trend. And this is not due to rapid growth in employment. Europe has not as yet made the most of the recent technological progress, simply. And in general, there remains also a great deal of room for improved functioning of all three product, labor, and capital markets. We are also not on track to meet some of the specific targets of the Lisbon strategy, like the research and development share in GDP that we hoped to have at the level of 3%, or halving the number of early school leavers. Also in the social dimension, if I may just allow me to use the gender factor, then say that gender gaps in the labor market still are much too wide, according to any standards, I would say. And we continue, I think, not really preparing our, being prepared to bear the consequences of the demographic change in Europe. And here I mean the aging of the population, but also the declining number of the new entrants into to the workforce. And I'm sure that many of you would share this view that without reforms of pension systems and without reforms of retirement provisions, without improved labor market performance, and also without a reasonable attitude towards immigration in Europe, demographic change might foreshadow even more serious challenges to our economic and social model. We usually, when we think of European demography and especially of aging, we normally think in terms of the consequences for the social security systems. We are sometimes afraid that they will all go bankrupt one day if we don't have reforms of those systems. But we less often refer to such consequences of aging population as the diminishing propensity to embark on risky undertakings, general, I think, negative attitudes to anything which is related with risk. And this, I think, is one of the also of the reasons that we are not that innovative as we would like to be. But before you indeed accuse me, and rightly so, of constructing a kind of doomsday scenario, let me reassure you that, in my view, all is not lost, and we have also made a lot of progress in many areas, and let me say that at least what the Commission has been doing over the last years after 2000, I think has brought a major progress to the Lisbon objectives, and I hope that we will complete the Financial Services Action Plan, which is although followed but at a slightly more leisurely pace than one might have hoped. I also hope that the completion of the internal market will also include the most difficult directives with which we are coping. We have been coping for years without being able to complete them. So Lisbon certainly has not been a waste of time, and part of the added value of the Lisbon agenda, which I consider very important, has been to put the economy, the European economy, at the top of domestic political agenda of the Union. And this is above all a reminder that a number of things that we regard as precious in Europe, such as our social welfare system or our concerns for the environment, they depend on a successful economy, whether we want it or not. And a year ago, the Council has invited a group of experts led by Wim Kok, the former Dutch Prime Minister, to prepare a report assessing the progress in implementation of Lisbon agenda, and I would like to mention three recommendations which Wim Kok presented in the report, which are find of key importance. And first, the authors say that the Union should not only persuade the member states to implement Lisbon, but that the Union, and it in fact refers to the Commission first of all, should back up its words as far as possible with financial incentives from the Union budget. The second remark, the second important recommendation, is linked to the fact that we identified the lack of ownership of the Lisbon process in the member states, and that's why the report is requiring the establishment of a partnership for growth and employment, which I consider very important, this issue of ownership. And the third, the report calls also on each member state to adopt a strategic approach involving a national action plan, a Mr. or Mrs. Lisbon, and this approach is in my understanding, is increasingly being taken into account by many member states. And in all these three areas, the regional policy plays its role. And that's why in the Commission's proposals, which we presented yesterday in the Parliament for the renewed Lisbon strategy, the regional policy is playing a much prominent role than it did in the past. It contributes in all three areas. First, maybe just a word on the financial incentives. The structural and cohesion funds are the main instrument the EU has for increasing growth, enhancing investment. And moreover, this is not just any spending instrument. As I was trying to say, it's not about the transfer to the poor, which would reduce income disparities only in the short run. And as you know, in the Union, the transfers for income equalization remain entirely a matter of national governments in the member states. EU regional and cohesion funds have a different logic. They are seeking to invest, as I was trying to say earlier, so as to raise the long-run growth potential of the weakest regions and also to improve the competitiveness of the regions or across the regions in Europe. So that can be sort of exemplified by policy measures which are part of the, or which are adopted in the cohesion policy. I'm thinking here about the basic infrastructure. I'm thinking here about the research and development expenditures to support the innovation. I'm thinking here also about the support for the labor markets and also the support for the enterprise development. So this is the investment which is mobilizing the indigenous potential, which I believe every region, even the smallest one in Europe, have. And I always think when I look at the map of Europe or Eurasia, better said, I always recommend to everybody that from time to time one should, when one thinks of Europe, one should look at this map to see what a tiny continent indeed Europe is. It's just a small peninsula attached to this huge continent. So I don't think that we can really afford, we can allow ourselves to leave aside the growth potential of even the smallest region. I think we have to mobilize all the regions to contribute to the growth, to contribute to jobs in Europe. Structural regional policy, structural funds, it's not only about money, if I may say that, because beyond this financial economic impact of additional investment, there is an equally important, I would say, effect in terms of governance. Every program is developed through a very close partnership. I visited in Manchester and a university incubator, which is exactly based on unbelievable successful partnership involving the authorities. Of course, at the European level, Commission is everywhere with its bureaucracy, then also the regional and local level, the social partners, the civil society. So as a result of this partnership approach, the strategies are more effectively owned by those responsible for designing them, by those who co-finance, but also by those who benefit from them. And being involved in preparing European programs obliges, of course, the regions to think long-term and to identify strategic priorities. So this is additional value of the Union's approach to the regional policy. The support that comes from the common budget means that they are those regions, they are afforded a degree of isolation from the day-to-day political or other pressures that can have and normally have a distorting effect on any public expenditure strategy. The planning period in case of structural funds stretches over 7 years, so it goes well beyond the electoral cycle, political cycle of any member state, and this is also a long enough period to invest in infrastructure projects, and this is also a value added which I would like to mention, this political stability to the structural investment and also financial stability and financial guarantee which is given to the infrastructural investment. And in order to, and that's where we are hated usually in the Commission, is the fact that in order to ensure the effectiveness of expenditure, the implementation of those programs includes also very specific management, very specific monitoring and evaluation requirements. And the EU, as we all know, does not have the best of reputations when it comes to bureaucracy. And I think this rather unfair, frankly, though when I was a member state, I was having exactly the same view. And sometimes it seems as if we cannot win. If we are rigorous, I mean, if the Commission is rigorous, we are accused of binding the the policy process up in rolls of red tape. But at the first hint of fraud or mismanagement, even if that turns out at the end of the day on closer inspection to be a failure of controls at the national level, it seems we can never be too strict. So that's the fate, and the Commission from time to time allows itself to play this role of scapegoat when we want that things are done. But if we ask the people who manage the EU-funded programs in the member states, of course some of them may be obliged to toe their government's line on regional policy in general, but they will tell you nevertheless, I would say, that the EU has improved the administration of regional policy in general, including also programs which are financed entirely at national level. And this is, I think, true in here in London. I had a meeting with the mayor of London today, extremely interesting meeting. And it is also true in Lisbon and Ljubljana or Krakow as well. So for the next financial perspective, we tabled a proposal for an extensive reform of the policy as of 2007. And our proposals reflect our desire to see the EU budget contribute more effectively to the realization of the Lisbon agenda. And of course the essential background, as I said at the beginning, to these reforms is the enlargement of the Union of 20, to the Union of 25, because indeed this enlargement has had a dramatic impact on regional income disparities. In the new member states, it's 92% of the population living in regions which have GDP per capita below the level of 75% of the EU average, which is for my policy, as you know, the threshold used for determining the eligibility for the highest level of aid. And also the GDP per head in the 10 new member states, as we all today know very well, is below 50% of the EU 25 figure. So no doubt, I would say, we should always remember this, that less prosperous societies have joined the club. And that's why within this total package which we are proposing for the 2007-2013 of 336 billion euro for the entire period, we are proposing to focus first of all on the poorest, and this is I would say understood in terms of the consequences of enlargement, but I would like also to say that for us the poorest regions are not only the poorest regions of the poorest countries, but they're also very poor regions in the EU 15, and there are also pockets of poverty, there are also pockets of social problems, but there are also pockets of unused, excellent growth and competitiveness potential in the poorer regions of the old member states. So for the new member states, being part of this convergence objective, of this objective of the new cohesion policy, which will be focusing on the poorest regions of the Union, in the new member states, what they will get represents, in most of the cases, a stimulus of 4% of the GDP, which is higher than the Union ever applied historically to any of the former 15 member states. So this has the potential, I think, to make a real and long-run difference to the level of development in those countries and through them also in the rest of the of Europe. But as I say, the policy needs to continue to intervene outside the poorest regions as well, and here is where the Commission's proposal is the most radical with regard to those regions which are outside the poorest areas. They, in effect, the proposals are a specific response to the limited success which I was trying to present to you without making it too gloomy. So it is, this proposal is the response to the limited success in progressing towards the Lisbon objectives, and especially in the fields of research and development and innovation in respect to the accessibility and also sustainable development. And these proposals would allow the regions to contribute to the Lisbon process and to make it more effective. And let me just quote what Michael Porter has recently concluded. I like this sentence. He said that since many of the essential determinants of economic performance appear to reside in regions, national policies will be necessary but not sufficient. And that's why we propose to keep 18% of the budget for use in regions that, though they are not the poorest, but they still face competitiveness and employment challenges, and they have the potential that can be simply woken up or mobilized for growth and jobs. And then the remaining 4%, 78%, the first objective, 17, close to 18, the second, and then the remaining 4% of the budget would go on projects linked to the interregional cooperation, which I believe in this so strongly diversified Europe, the interregional cooperation is a must. I think it's an additional synergy there is there, and I think there is such an accumulation of experience, of expertise already existing in the regions, that not to use the networking, not to use the interregional cooperation would be simply a sin, would be a waste of resources that do exist. So as I have indicated, the future of the proposals of the Commission is very much bound up with the negotiations on future European policy priorities and also the financing as set out in our financial perspective, draft financial perspective for the 2007-13. And this is a difficult discussion in the Council of Ministers. We are going through this. We have been doing it for some months. And of course, we all know, and some of us even see it as a natural tendency, that no member state is really keen on transferring public revenue to the union budget. But as I have already mentioned, was trying to tell, to show in what I was saying, the Commission, fully aware of the pressures which also come from the Commission on member states' budget, has been prudent in its proposals. Not only we have proposed no increase in cohesion policy spending as a proportion of EU GNI, because we stay at the level of 0.41% of EU GNI, but we have also proposed measures that will mean that available resources are used more effectively and also more efficiently. And the debate on the money, on the budget, is especially robust with a group of six member states who are calling for major cuts in the Commission's proposal, and with spending on common agricultural policy already ring-fenced in 2002. Any savings would have to be found elsewhere, and that's what is worrying us in particular. And in view of everything that I have said on the contribution of regional policy, of European regional policy to good governance, I hope you will understand that I am among the many who believe that the proposals of the Group of Six would be a retrograde step. But here in London, in LSE, I would like to say that this would be a step back in political terms too, I believe. I think with more than 100 million more European citizens after Bulgaria and Romania joins, with those development gaps indeed dramatically increased, and with all those challenges related to the need to grow faster, to create more jobs and to become more competitive, reducing the EU budget down to 1% would be, in my view, neither wise nor justified. But this, by saying that there would be also a political consequence to this, By this, I want to say that this would have a negative impact on political visibility of the Union. Frankly, I don't say it's very important, but frankly, in reality, the European regional policy is the most visible presence of the Union on the ground, and take it away, and the Union just becomes an abstract entity for laying down rules, directives, and regulations in view of ordinary citizens. It would be also a political mistake because we would create new divisions in Europe between West that gives and the East that receives, because with the budget cut and with all this rhetoric that the poorest from the new member states cannot pay, that would mean that we will have this new division in Europe. And I think it is fully justified, of course, to target regional policy on the poorest, but it would be impossible, I think, to explain to the politicians, to the governments, to the ministers of finance. It would be impossible to explain to the people in the West, less well-off parts of the richer countries, experiencing industrial closures, high unemployment, social deprivation, which we have also a lot of that in London, that they are no longer entitled to EU regional aid. And finally, I believe that the Union and especially our national governments need also to listen to what the regions themselves are saying across Europe. And I can tell you I travel a lot, and we, in the Commission also, we received recently around 300 contributions to the major debate on the future of regional and cohesion policy, and there is overwhelming support at regional level for this ambitious intervention that we are proposing. And it is, I think, interesting to reflect that the development of regional policy and the creation of the regional fund many years ago owed much to the persuasive arguments coming from London soon after the accession of the United Kingdom to the European communities. And these arguments are, I think, as valid today as they were 30 years ago. And let me remind you also, Lord Wallace, that many of them were derived from the insights of illustrious London School of Economic professors as well. So I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very much indeed, Commissioner. We now have some time for questions, and I'm very happy to recognise people. We'll have some microphones. Is there a microphone upstairs as well? If not, we'll ask people to shout when necessary. That was a good radical definition of regional policy. I recall a previous regional policy commissioner here talking about the need to make sure that regional funds were spent in every single part of the European Union. And the question of how far one skews funds is one which is, as the Commissioner has rightly remarked, one of the most delicate ones. I think about this every time I go up to Saltaire, as I pass the plaque on Saltaire Railway Station, which says, we opened with funds from the European Regional Development Fund. And I noticed the other weekend that just by the Leaning Tower of Pisa there was a plaque, which also says that the Leaning Tower has been repaired with funds from the European Union Regional Fund. The question of how thinly one spreads the funds across all 25 member states is one of the ones which is being most carefully negotiated. Can I ask who would like to intervene, and can I ask all of you please to give your name as you rise and keep your questions short.
My name is Stefan Collignon. I was very interested in what you said, particularly as I feel Lisbon was a little bit my baby, in the sense that I worked with Antonio Guterres even before the Lisbon summit on some of the ideas there. And I was sort of what you call Mr. Lisbon in the German government in the year 2000. And out of what you say, there are two questions that come up. The first one is that I remember when we were actually negotiating Lisbon, At one point I said to my Portuguese partners, this is crazy what we are doing here, because we are going in the opposite direction of what we should be doing, and we know it's not going to work, which is we are going intergovernmental, while really this is a process that should go to the European Commission. And then my partner said, yes, yes, you are right, and of course Antonio Guterres agrees with you totally, but the Commission at the moment is so weak that the only institution we have to push it forward is the Council. Well, I think both things were true, and what we actually see, what you call the lack of ownership, is actually the fact that if it is intergovernmental, nobody owns the thing. So if you want to resharpen the focus of this, doesn't it also mean that you need to give ownership to the European Commission and that they should be really the ones who are driving this? And then a second question I'd like you to comment on is which is related to the fact that there's an economic, that somehow the performance both of Lisbon and performance in the regions is related to economic growth. Of course, the purpose of Lisbon was to increase macroeconomic management. That was the whole point of Lisbon in the beginning, and it was dropped very quickly soon after. It's pretty much disappeared now from what came out this week from the Commission, in the sense that at one point we said that we should define a growth target and not just say it's a, this was Blair's idea about the most competitive economy in world history. But on the other hand, when you don't get the growth, then of course you have the problem with the fiscal deficits, and then you have the Stability and Growth Pact, and then the finance ministers must reduce the cost and their expenditure, and guess what? You're not going to get the funds you want to get because Mr. Eichel has to balance his budget.
Let me take a couple more questions and then we'll pull them all in. Yes. Abby, sorry.
My name's Abby Innes. Can I actually ask you a question relating to Poland? And Poland is a very successful case of transition, but Poland is clearly having enormous political difficulties in managing its serious fiscal dilemmas still. The problem of finding sufficient funds for social transfers to maintain the social peace, and really a continuing difficulty in finding public spending for pro-growth factors, whether it's research and development, investment, training. And Poland, as a very successful case, is suffering obviously the same dilemmas as the rest of the region. Is there any sense in which you would argue that without structural fund continuity, or without this the budget that you propose, there are real political risks in the new member states that, for example, we saw the Polish government last year collapse in the process of attempting radical measures, radical cuts, that this is, Poland has had austerity measures to keep reforms going for 14 years. It's very difficult to continue this process to comply with Maastricht. So, for example, is there a comparison with the political functions of the common agricultural policy in the early years in maintaining political stability in Central Europe, or would you not take it that far? Thank you.
Question over there, back, by the wall.
Thank you. Marcus Starling. My question is, can we meet the Lisbon goals if we don't get the increase in the budget that the Commission has asked for? And if we don't get that increase, what do we do? Can we give up on the Lisbon goals, or is there a way to achieve them without the larger increase?
Question just there.
Hi there. My name's James Stewart. I've got a couple of very quick questions, one internal to the European Union, another external. The first is, I think much of the debate about convergence, at least as far as I see it in the financial markets, is conducted in terms of what those that want to converge with the old states can learn from the established economies like France and Germany. I'd like to pose the question the other way around. I think there's probably quite a great deal that France, Germany and the UK...
Sorry.
Yeah, you can't hear it. Oh, right, okay. I think there's probably quite a lot that economies like France, Germany and the UK can learn from economies like Poland, Czech Republic and so on. So I'd like to hear what you've got to say about that. But more importantly, from a financial market perspective, which is what I speak from, I think one issue about the Lisbon agenda is not whether the benchmarking is realistic, but that the world economy has moved on in the last 5 years. And maybe the benchmarks ought to look at emergent economies like India, China, for example. The whole notion of benchmarking's changed, really. And I know that the decisions that my company makes, which are global decisions, are in no way restricted to the European Union. So I'd just like to hear what you've got to say about the way in which benchmarks have moved in the last 5 years or so.
Question: should Eastern European economies be teaching West European economies rather than vice versa, as Vaclav Klaus used to argue very vigorously?
It was only about agriculture, I guess, what Klaus was saying. Well, it's true that Lisbon is a mixture. That's why ownership matters, because there's no chance, I think, that we have clear streamlined ownership, that it can be either the Commission or the Member State. And in fact, what you did in 2000 was also a joint ownership envisaged. There were targets which could be achieved only through the activities of the Commission in terms of the single market, the progress in the completion of the single markets. What the Commission was responsible for, I think, much of that has been delivered, maybe at a slow pace, but much really has happened. But then, as we know, the responsibility for the economic policy in the Union stays largely with the Member States. So all the structural reforms which most of the European Member States continue to need, they have been in the hands of the Member States, and the role of the Member States through this open coordination method has been, I think, seen as decisive for the success of Lisbon, and that was where we exactly failed. And one can think, because the Commission, not really feeling the responsibility or not being given the responsibility, did not carry on the process of blaming and shaming or monitoring, benchmarking, or maybe Commission did it, but did it wrongly. Maybe those the number of the indicators that already Poland was also sent at the end of the year to respond to and to show the problem. Maybe this was a wrong approach. So maybe also the Commission failed on the way it was monitoring the whole process, or maybe there was simply no really political will. Maybe we were involved in so many other challenges at that time in Europe that we just gave up. But maybe it's just the question, which probably in Germany you can be a good example of this, the lack of social capital, lack of capacity on the side of the societies to accept reforms which in principle are extremely painful from the social point of view. Or maybe the normal political cycle did not allow the governments in Europe to use those years for difficult reforms. There's probably a combination of factors, which is linked to the fact that most of the economic reforms are in the Union in the hands of Member States. And that was delivered at the pace which was sort of dictated by the internal politics in the Member States. And also there was no role model. There's probably a whole combination of factors. But clearly my understanding of what happened in Lisbon was this double character of ownership. The Commission with its limited responsibility, and the Member States with the open coordination method without strong monitoring mechanisms. Probably one should now write a book, Why Lisbon Failed, I guess, and just to try to understand. But when I even look at Poland, I mean, you usually have a very limited window of opportunity when you come to power. to introduce the most difficult reforms. And if you lose this moment, then you are unable. And so internal politics probably decided in Europe and the paralyzes. But it's for you, to Professor Collignon, to write, I think, a new book on this. Where I agree fully with you, and I think I understand and I support your, if I understand you correctly, growth is absolutely essential. I mean, without growth, we are all we're stuck with all the problems. And even to if we now had growing European economies, there wouldn't be this discussion on the budget, this humiliating discussion on the 0.05% of the GNI, whether we can have it or not, can have it. That's why I think absolutely growth is no doubt about that. And without growth, the macroeconomic stability would be probably a stumbling block for any further reforms. And that's absolutely clear. But that's why I'm saying that we have no other choice but to use this one set of the EU budget, which we're also having under the cohesion policy, to do as much as we can at the regional level to create growth, because growth doesn't come from nowhere. No? It is created at the enterprise level, at the local level, and what in fact we are proposing through the reform also is to not only to think in terms of short-term acceleration of growth, but we are also thinking on in terms of creating foundations for long-term sustained and sustainable and growth. And this is the challenge. We are not talking about getting out of a recession. We are talking about long-term growth path that would have its foundation. And the foundation is linked to probably the properly understood competitiveness, which includes also salary growth rate, the real salaries and growth and everything which decides on the social sustainability and environmental sustainability. So that's my that's on this. Whether there are political functions of funding coming under different policies, I understand, from the common budget. You are asking in the context of new member states mostly this question. And of course, if you look at Poland, and if I also, when I remember what I've been through in the course of the negotiations with regards to the agriculture and mostly, definitely there are political functions. And I must say it's quite unfortunate, because it would be good to see the integration only the accession only through perspective of being back in Europe where we always belonged, and this political stability and peace and all those things, and to think in terms of solidarity, which is not really based on money. But unfortunately, maybe or fortunately, this is also about money, and there are groups of societies. They are not guilty that they are sensitive to the financial motivation and stimuli, because they have never, like Polish village or Polish agricultural sector, they have never in the history of Polish agriculture received any cash from anywhere. So it was no wonder that this factor exists, and that this factor is being used by the politicians. So the political dimension is absolutely clear, and the political stability depends on definitely on also on the success of the integration. And we already can see it in Poland, where the support for the, well, it's also there's a good prime minister and good government, but also the support for the accession, for the membership in the union is also seen, which is increasing, it's above 70% again, is also seen through the perspective of the open bank accounts where you get the direct payments and with which you can also finance the study of your daughter or son. So it's I don't blame anybody. That's why it will always be, I think, politically. And if you come here and if you talk or to any other old member state, you can also see how political it is, the discussion on the budget and the discussion on constitution. It's everything extremely strongly politicized. It's just part of the game, and I don't know whether this is good or bad. I think this is good that there is a political dimension to this. It's very important, but because also people will in the next election will not vote, I think, on those parties that base their political campaign on the lies about the union or on the also promises about the union. So it's important. Can we achieve the Lisbon without budget? I mean, of course, without money. I'm sorry to say, so there is no Europe, of course. And with less money, there can be more Europe. This is not mine sentence, but I think it's true. So there is a link between what can be done and the amount of money. But what we are now trying also to introduce to the perception of the union and union's budget is that we are also caring very strongly, very much about the efficiency, effectiveness, so this factor of spending the public money, which is the funds, efficiently and effectively, with value added, which must be clearly proved. That might help those who are against the increase of budget in absolute terms, because we are not talking about the increase of budget in relative terms, because we maintain it at the same level of its share in GNI. Without that would be extremely difficult in the concrete case of cohesion policy. If the reduction goes too far, then we can't maintain the architecture we proposed. There would be no sense to have objective two if you don't have enough money. You can't have objective two if the money is really limited overwhelmingly. So it's there is this link as well. However, I am against this thinly spreading of the funds across all regions when it comes to those objectives where you should have more focus, because you can spread it thinly with regard to the poorest. I mean, all the poorest should get it, but of course we must see that they spend it properly. But when it comes then to the richer regions and under objective two, I would be against this spreading across all the regions. I would rather see the on the side of the member states, because they will be deciding some focus on really on those pockets of needs that you have in the regions. Who should teach whom? I think everybody should teach everybody, frankly, and everybody should learn from everybody. The problem is, of course, to be able to learn from somebody's mistakes, which is sometimes, I think, impossible. Everybody wants to have his or her own mistakes and then to draw lessons from this. But I also think that learning from others is really an art, and I think that the new member states have also shown over the transition period that you can be successful through learning, or you can fail through learning if you don't know how to learn. And this internalization of somebody's lessons, and it is extremely important. But in talking concretely about the new and the old member states, it's clearly a lot. Transition, I think, produced a lot of lessons for the old member states as well, and the capacity to reform, and the need to reform, and the all sorts of new approaches which we were taught in the new member states by experts coming from the old member states who never managed to introduce those reforms in their own countries. But we made it, and I think we are a visible proof that if you want, you can really learn. The problem is, of course, you can't do it alone. I mean, you can't. Political elites tend to run, and the people do not sort of stay behind, and then they become unhappy, and then you can't run anymore. Because you are out of power, so the problem, of course, is to have to talk to the people and to get everybody on board, and that's why this partnership approach, which the cohesion policy, for example, has been introducing over the years, which makes I think which helps with the success of many of the programs and projects, is probably extremely important. But I think the list of things we can learn from the new member states is very long, so I wouldn't embark on this exercise.
Thank you. I should say to all the students here, there will be a question on the open method of coordination in your exams at the end of the year.
How
does the open method of coordination work, or does the open method of coordination work? You may wait and see.
And you should know that open method of coordination for the Brits is absolutely monument and extremely important. So you can't criticize open method of coordination in LSE, probably.
We have room for perhaps for two or three more questions. Is there above who wants to ask a question? Okay. Or on this block which I haven't been looking at properly? Okay, there was a question over there.
Thank you. Michael McGowan. I think the Commissioner, you've been very clear about your attitude about spreading the funds thinly. I think it is true that the regional policy has been one of the more popular policies in many ways of the European Union, you know, from Saltaire to Pisa. And I think there is a need to be still winning the argument for European cooperation in many parts of Europe, including in the UK, and I think to some extent in Poland as well. And I wondered if you might even consider sort of looking at lost leaders in each of the member states, just to keep the argument for European cooperation, because I think we're still to do a lot of persuading. But I really wanted to ask you about what is the attitude of yourself and your colleagues on the Commission now, after this substantial enlargement, in relation to any future enlargement. You've mentioned Bulgaria and Romania. Turkey's knocking on the door. I've just come back from the elections in Ukraine, and there's a very enthusiastic and determined bid to actually become part of the European family. And I wonder if you're feeling, or anyone else's, on the Commission that, look, let's hold our breath for a while and say to the Ukraine, for example, that seems to have a very good case as far as I can see, you know, you're saying, well, look, we've probably been rushing too quickly, and some of your colleagues and I wonder if you could comment on that, because I wouldn't like to see the project slowing down. I think that it can enlarge besides deepen, and I just wonder what your feeling is with fresh eyes.
Thanks.
We're not so fresh, I'm afraid.
Last question here. But, it doesn't stop at Ukraine. Well, we're giving the new government of Georgia has now adopted two official flags. The second official flag is blue with 12 gold stars.
Right, thank you. Commissioner, I'm going to be very radical and ask you a question about regional policy. And the question concerns several of the larger new member states, Czech Republic, Slovak Republic, Poland and Hungary especially, where the one observation, especially with the new data we've just seen last week from your Directorate General, is that internal disparities are increasing. The border regions of Poland with the east and with the southeast, they are the poorest parts of the European Union. The same is true in Slovakia. And yet we talk about the regional policy being at predominantly for the new member states at national level. Do you think enough is being done within the plans to ensure convergence within Poland, to take that example, as well as between Poland and the rest of the EU?
Thank you.
Yeah. On this spreading funds, I would like to be well understood with regard to the generally to the cohesion policy. I have very strong view on the need to continue the support for the poorest regions who lost the statistical eligibility because of the enlargement. The situation in those regions has not moved a millimeter after 1st of May last year, but they all of a sudden found themselves in a completely different situation. So we must be serious about this fact that enlargement has just produced a new set of statistics, but nothing more with regard to those regions. So I can't imagine that we could deprive those regions overnight of the support. That's why we are proposing this phasing out approach under the convergence objective for the statistics affected regions, which is more or less 17 billion euro for the for those regions coming from the EU 15. So in terms of spreading in this sense, I mean, yes, we are spreading across all the poorest, both in the old and the new member states. But then when it comes to the, for example, under Objective 2, to this part of Objective 2, where you have the old regions potentially eligible to the support, I would be against spreading it equally across all the remaining richer regions, because I think that would be a sort of potentially a waste of resources. That's why we are proposing for the Objective 2 a thematic focus, concentration related to the Lisbon objectives, and then we will leave it to the member states to decide how they are going to organize and allocate the money under Objective 2 to those who can contribute, where the mobilization of the capital for the growth and indigenous capital for the growth and competitiveness and jobs is can be supported through the structural funds. So where you need spreading, you should do it. Where you don't need it, because sometimes spreading evenly is dangerous and is inefficient, you shouldn't do it. So that's my more or less response. On the future enlargement, I remember my major lines before we joined the Union, that the Union might need some time for consolidation after this biggest ever enlargement by 10 countries. So there was some egoism already at that stage, probably. I do think that we need some consolidation, and exactly what we are doing now with focusing on growth, on cohesion. That's a kind of consolidation of the union, of the enlarged union. But enlargement of the union is a political process which has nothing to do, in my view, with, maybe I'm exaggerating, but not much to do with geography, let's call it this way. Or economy, or whatever. It is a political decision of the member states, unanimous decision, if they believe that we should have a new member state, and this is justified politically. I believe we should aim at this, and that's why I was supportive for the decision in Athens in 2003, it was, I guess, on the southeastern, on the Western Balkans, that to give the future, the pace to, for the further enlargement. That's why I was not against Turkey, because I believe this is the political decision which we will take. But I want to make it clear that, because many people see the enlargement in terms of fears, of threats to the financing for the current member states, which I think is a false fear, because we know very well that when a serious enlargement comes, member states get together as they did in Berlin, and they simply decide how much money we want to spend on this enlargement. As was decided in Berlin in 1999, that we will have only 40 billion for the at that time seven or first five and seven member states. We had finally more of them. And then once we have how much money we have, we just decide about the way we phase in into the policies, into the funds, into the budgets. So it's never, there is never this threat that this will be a sort of killing factor for the existing financial system, because it's also always a decision made by member states. So I think that we shouldn't sort of demonize the enlargement as it's a natural thing, I would say, part of the project, of the European project, that enlargement should happen, and we all decide unanimously how fast, who is first, who is later. And that's why I also believe that one day Ukraine, which is not today on the path towards membership or association, because it is under the European neighborhood policy, that Ukraine one day will also be probably on the path to accession. That's why I always say to the Ukrainian colleagues, just get ready. Once you are ready, probably nobody would say we don't want you, and use the action plan under the neighborhood policy to the maximum, and this will work towards your accession as well. So I don't know whether we should rush or not. I think it goes on sort of natural. I mean, the moment comes where we all mature and we feel that we can do it. I am against any really planning or making illusions or producing the basis for dreams and this kind of thing. Be very pragmatic on this. I think the one of the
sort of dimensions of European integration is that it is not limited to the Union, that it has always impact on the neighbourhood. It has, in fact, it has always had pan-European impact, no matter whether this was the Union, the community of 6, 12 or 15. And this is also happening now. So there is always this broader Europe which is under the influence of the European integration. Let's maintain it, and when time comes, let's get bigger. On the Visegrad member states that you mentioned, and I couldn't quite understand why you say that regional policy is on national level, why it should be more regional. I think you referred to the fact that in the first period of using the funds, which is the 2004-2006, in most of the new member states, there is an integrated regional program, and it's not like in Poland, you have one integrated and then sectoral programs. You don't have a program separate for a region, for every region. And if you were referring to this, it's true that they are integrated at the national level. Still, there are projects which have regional dimensions. So there is the regional policy is not at national level in any sense in the new member states. But the way it is organized, it makes the impression. But regional policy is based on the regional eligibility, and it has nothing to do with the national approach. But I agree with you that in those countries, especially in Poland, but not only, also in Hungary, in Slovakia, as you mentioned, in Czech Republic, I don't know that much, the differences are enormous between the regions, and that's why the regions should be very active. Using the funds, and they are doing it so far. They have been doing it very well. The first 9 months, what was supposed to be done during those now 9 months was done in 100%. So I hope they will continue like this. The fear is, of course, that the richer, usually, as we know from development theories, get richer and the poorer stay poorer. That the better prepared regions are usually the richer regions, and that's always a problem. And then as the allocation depends also on the population density, on the unemployment rate, it's not always that the poorer regions get more to overcome the barriers to development. So it's very individual, probably, but very region-specific.
Thank you very much. I think we really ought, unfortunately, to pull this to an end. For those who have received invitations, I regret it is only by invitation, there will be a reception taking place in the atrium of the old building, the Student Services Centre, shortly as we walk over there. I should repeat our thanks to the LSE Polish Society for the role it has played in preparing this. I think you understand, Anuta, that we are highly international. Institution, we have some very strong student national societies which help to hold the LSE together and provide a lot of things. I hope you also understand that for staff members here, it's very difficult to visit Brussels, either the Commission or the Council Secretariat,
right,
without running into former students of the LSE. And
those
whom you have been addressing this evening may well include a number of people who will be on the staff of the Commission or the Council Secretariat by the time you leave the Commission. I very much hope they will. But thank you very much for coming here. It was extremely interesting, and we wish you luck in developing a coherent regional policy, and much more luck in persuading member governments to accept it.
I thank you once more. But I just wanted to say to those who did not receive the invitation, I didn't receive it either, so don't worry.